You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner. It's entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition That Satisfies the Human Being, The Relationship Between Spiritual Science and Natural Science, 11 Lectures, translated by Christian von Arnim. This is the first lecture of the first four, which are our first section, and that first section is called The Value of Thinking for a Cognition That Satisfies the Human Being. It was given in Dornach on the 17th of September, 1915. For research in and contemplation of the physical world, it is above all what we may call a matter of the heart for human beings to find their bearings in the relationships between the physical world, in which they spend their existence between birth and death, and the higher worlds to which they actually belong. We are, after all, quite clear about the fact that in the human being, however vague their thinking, there, nevertheless, lives an eminently clear feeling, a clear sense that they should know at least something about these relationships in some form. For no matter how vaguely the human being may think about the higher worlds, no matter how much they may, for various reasons, despair of being able to know anything about them, it is simply natural and appropriate to human feeling and sensibility to relate to a higher world. Certainly, we might object that there are nevertheless numerous people, especially in our present materialistic age, who either deny in some form or other that there is a spiritual world at all, or at least deny that the human being can know anything about it. But we can also say that a person first has to learn to behave negatively, in quotes, toward the spiritual world, so to speak, for it is not natural, in quotes, for human beings to deny a spiritual, a supersensory world. They first have to get there through all kinds of theories. They must first be mistaught, we might say, in order to deny a spiritual world with any degree of seriousness. So that when we speak of the natural human being, we can, nevertheless, do so in such a way that it is appropriate to their feeling to turn the soul's gaze upward in some way to the spiritual worlds. However, if there is even just a possibility that there are people who want to know nothing at all about spiritual worlds, there must be something in human nature that makes it difficult to determine the relationship with the spiritual world. And this relationship seems to be difficult to think about. For we see that in the course of history, which we can trace, a very great number of all kinds of philosophies and world views have appeared, which seem to contradict each other. But I have often explained that it only seems to be so. For if it were easy for human beings to determine their relationship with the supersensory world, then seemingly contradictory worldviews would not fill the history of worldviews. So it is already clear from this that it is difficult, in a sense, to determine the relationship with the spiritual world. And therefore we can ask where this difficulty comes from. What is actually present in the soul of the human being that they find it difficult to relate to the spiritual world? Now, if we examine all the attempts that are made outside a spiritual scientific worldview, that is, let us say, in plain philosophy or in external science, and ask ourselves what these attempts are actually aiming at, what underlies them, then we must say, if we study these attempts, if we look at what kind of soul power people mainly use to find out about the relationship between the physical and the spiritual world, then we find that people again and again, discounting isolated attempts, let me say, see above all in the thinking that soul ability, soul activity, which properly applied, could lead to saying something, to determining something about the relationship of the human being to the supersensory worlds. It is therefore necessary to consider the thinking work of the soul, and to ask ourselves, what is it about the thinking, about giving thought, regarding the relationship of the human being, who lives in the physical world, with the spiritual worlds? What is it about this relationship of the thinking with the spiritual worlds? So, the question, what is the value of thinking for a cognition that satisfies the human being? I would like to consider this question today in preparation for the discussion of other questions with you. I would like us to prepare ourselves, as it were, for a worthy discussion by considering the question of the value of thinking for cognition. Well, we get behind the thinking, so to speak, if we go about it in the following way. After all, we have already indicated in the course of the last lectures that certain peculiarities of the thinking, or better still, of the thoughts, need to be considered. I have pointed out how there are many people who see it as a downright mistake in all scientific thinking if this scientific thinking is not just a mere copy, a mental photograph of an external reality. For these people say, if thinking is to have any relationship at all with what is real, with reality, then it must not add anything of itself to this reality. For at the moment when thinking adds something to reality, we are not dealing with an image, with a photograph of reality, but with a fantasy, with a fantasy image. And so that we do not have to deal with such a fantasy image, we must strictly see to it that no one includes in their thoughts anything that is not a mere photograph of external reality. Now, an easy line of thought will immediately lead you to say to yourself, indeed, for the outer physical world, for what we call the physical plane, this seems to be quite correct and self-explanatory. It seems to correspond to a quite correct feeling that we must not add anything to reality through the thinking if we don't want to have fantasy images instead of an image of reality. For the physical plane, we can indeed truly say that it is absolutely correct to abstain from adding anything through the thinking to that which we receive from the outside through perception. Now, I would like to draw your attention to two philosophers, Aristotle and Leibniz, in relation to the view that is found in what has just been said. Aristotle, who to a certain extent summarizes the Greek worldview, is a philosopher who himself was no longer initiated in any way into the secrets of the spiritual world, but who lived in the very first period after what I might call the, in quotes, age of initiation. Whereas before, all philosophers were still somehow affected by their initiation when they expressed philosophically what they knew as initiates. Plato, for example, who was a kind of initiate of the highest degree, but expressed himself philosophically. With Aristotle, we have to say that he no longer had any trace of initiation, but that there still existed all kinds of after-effects of initiation. So, here we have a philosopher who speaks only philosophically, without initiation, without any impulse of initiation, but who gives in his philosophy, by way of reason, what the initiates who went before him gave in a spiritual way. So, here we have Aristotle. Aristotle is the source of the words we now intend to consider. In brackets, Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, there is nothing in the intelligence which did not first pass through the senses, close quote. So, let us consider these words. There is nothing in, we can add, human intelligence, that is not in the senses. These words of Aristotle must not be interpreted in any kind of materialistic way. For Aristotle is far removed from any worldview that is even remotely materialistically tinged. In Aristotle, these words are not to be taken in terms of how we see the world, but epistemologically. That is, Aristotle refuses to believe that we can obtain knowledge of any world from within, but claims that we can have knowledge only by turning the senses toward the external world, by receiving sense impressions, and then forming concepts from these sense impressions with our reason. But he does not, of course, deny that we receive spiritual things with the sense impressions. He thinks of nature as being permeated by the spirit. Only, he says, we cannot arrive at the spiritual if we do not look out into nature. Here you can notice the difference to the materialist. The materialist concludes, there are only material things outside, and we only create concepts of material things. Aristotle thinks of the whole of nature as being filled with spirit. But the way of the human soul to reach the spirit is such that we must start from the sense perception and process the sense impressions into concepts. If Aristotle himself had still been touched by an impulse of initiation, he would not have said this, for then he would have known that if a person frees themselves from sense perception, in the way we have described, they will attain knowledge of the spiritual world from within. So, he did not want to deny the spiritual world, but only to show the path that human knowledge must take. These words, then, played a major role in the Middle Ages and were reinterpreted materialistically in the materialistic age. We need only change one small thing in these words of Aristotle. There is nothing in the world for the intellect that is not in the senses. And we have immediately formed materialism from it. It is the case, after all, that we need only make that which, in the sense of Aristotle, is the human path of knowledge into the principle of a worldview, and then we have materialism. Leibniz came up with similar words, so let us look at them as well. Leibniz is not yet that far in the past, in the 17th century. Let us now also consider these words of Leibniz. So Leibniz now says, there is nothing in the, we can again say, human intelligence, I only add human, that is not in the senses, except the intelligence itself, except the intellect itself. Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, there is nothing in the human intelligence that is not in the senses except the intelligence itself, except the intellect itself, close quote. So the intellect that the human being has working within themselves is not in the senses. In these two sentences in particular, you see proper textbook examples of how we can be completely in agreement with the formulation of a sentence, and yet how the sentence can be incomplete. Now, I don't want to dwell on the extent to which this sentence of Leibniz is also philosophically incomplete. Let us first note that Leibniz was of the opinion that the intellect itself is not somehow already founded in the senses, but that human beings must add the work of the intellect to what the senses give them. So that we can say, the intellect itself is an inner activity that has not yet passed through the senses. If you have followed the last lectures, you know that this inner work is already free of the senses and takes place in the etheric body of the human being. In our language, we can say, there is nothing in the intelligence working in the etheric body that is not in the senses, except the intelligence itself working in the etheric body. What is at work there does not enter from the senses. But thinking as such is in reality, if we look at it in true self-knowledge, such work in the etheric body, and this is what the philosophers call the intellect. So this thinking is work, working, we can say. And because for our spiritual scientific insight, Leibniz, even if he is not absolutely right, is nevertheless more right than Aristotle, we can say. This thinking, or rather this thinking activity, this thinking work in the human being, which is an activity of the etheric body, is not in the outer reality of the physical plane. For the physical plane reaches its limit in what it lets us recognize through the senses. So by placing ourselves as human beings on the physical plane, we introduce the intellect into it, which, however, is not itself in the physical world. And here we arrive at the difficulty of those philosophers who want to get to the bottom of the riddle of the universe through the intellect. These people must say to themselves, indeed, when I think about it, the intellect does not belong to the world of the senses, but I am now in a peculiar position. I know of no spiritual world other than only the intellect. It is a spiritual world behind the senses. So where does that leave the intellect as far as I am concerned? After all, it can get nothing, no content, if it does not inform himself about the outer physical world through the senses. It only stands for itself. But then the philosopher is confronted with a rather peculiar thing. He has to consider, I have in me an activity, the activity of the intellect. Through this activity of the intellect, I want to get behind the secrets of the sensory world. But I can only consider what is out there in the sensory world with thoughts. But these arise from something that does not itself belong to the sensory world. So, how are these thoughts connected with the sensory world? Even if I know that the intellect is something spiritual, I must still despair of being able to approach anything that is reality with the spiritual thing that I have here. Now I want to try to address the matter by means of a comparison. After all, we expressed the same thing in a different way in the last lectures. We expressed it by arriving at the recognition that we have mirror images of reality in what we produce through our thinking. That these mirror images are actually an addition to reality and are not realities themselves. You see, this is the same truth, only expressed differently philosophically here. We have to say, the intellect forms mirror images. These mirror images, as an image of the reality that is being reflected, are of indifference to reality. Because the reality that is being reflected does not need these mirror images. So that we could come to doubt the whole reality, the whole value of the reality of the thinking, of intelligence, to ask ourselves, does the thinking have any real meaning? Doesn't it actually already add something to external reality through what it is? Does any single thought have any real value if it is actually nothing more than a mirror image in relation to reality? But let us now endeavor to properly seek out the reality of the thought. In other words, if we want to answer the question, is a thought really something merely imaginary that has no real value? Or we can approach the question from another angle. Where, then, does thought have a reality? Well, as I said, I will try to illustrate this by a comparison. Here we have a clock. I pick up the clock, now have it in my hand. Everything that is the clock is external to the muscles and nerves of my hand. My hand and the clock are two different things. But let us assume that it is dark here, that I have never seen the clock and that I perceive the clock only by feeling. Then I would perceive something of the clock by stretching out my hand and grasping it. If you direct your attention to the clock, you will say to yourself, I can experience something of the reality of the clock by having it in my hand, by grasping it. But let us hypothetically assume, for a moment, that I had only one hand and not two. I would not be able to grasp the first hand with the second as I now grasp it in reality. I would probably be able to grasp the clock with one hand, but I would not be able to touch the hand itself with my other hand, at most with my nose, but will not do that right now. Nevertheless, the hand is just as real as the clock. How do I convince myself of the reality of the clock? By taking it in my hand, touching it. How do I convince myself of the reality of the hand? I could not convince myself by touching it, if I did not have a second hand. But I do know with inner certainty that I have a hand, that I possess the thing I have on me, to grasp the clock with just as much reality as I can vouch for the clock being real by grasping it. Do you notice the difference between the real hand and the real clock? I have to experience the reality of the hand in a different way from the reality of the clock. You can transfer this comparison wholly to human thinking, to the intellect. You can never grasp the intellect's comprehension so directly through the intellect itself, just as you cannot touch your own hand with the same hand. The intellect cannot perceive itself in the same way it perceives other things, but it is nevertheless convinced of its reality through inner certainty. It is an inner certainty whereby the intellect is convinced of its reality. But we must then understand this intellect, this work of the intellect, as an activity of the human subject. We have to be clear that the intellect is spiritually only a hand, as it were, that is stretched out to grasp something. We are speaking metaphorically here, but in very real images. And just as, on the one hand, my hand is able to convince me of the reality of the clock, namely, by the fact that I am able, for example, to feel with my hand the heaviness of the clock, the smoothness of the clock, I am able, therefore, through the nature of my hand, to learn everything that is real about the clock. So, on the other hand, I am able, through the reality of the intellect, to learn something about things other than what the senses learn. The intellect is therefore a grasping organ in the spiritual sense, which we must perceive in ourselves, not in the outside world. And you see, here lies the difficulty for philosophers. They believe that when they have thoughts about the world, the thoughts must come to them from outside. And then they realize that they do not come in from outside at all, but that the intellect makes these thoughts. And since they regard the intellect as alien to external reality, they must actually regard all thoughts as fantasy images. But we must ascribe a subjective reality to the intellect, a reality that is experienced internally. Then we have the realm of reality in which the intellect is perceived. Thus, by examining the actual nature of the intellect, we come to be able to say to ourselves, yes, everything that the intellect brings about may or need only be a reflection of external reality, but this reflection has come into being through the work of the real intellect. It is a human activity. And its reality consists in that the human being is at work as they acquire knowledge of the reality of the intellect through the intellect. So that we can say that the intellectual activity of the human being works in the human being, but it works, to begin with, in such a way that it is quite justified to say, what this intellect works on has no meaning for the world in which it works, just as the hand has no meaning for the clock, because for the clock it is supremely irrelevant whether or not it is grasped by the hand. The intellect is something that is there for the human being and in the human being, so that they produce some kind of image of things for themselves through the intellect. With regard to the things of the physical plane, however, everything that this intellect works on is unreal, a mirror image, dead, nothing living. We can say that the images of the physical world worked on in the intellect are lifeless, dead images. Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, intellectual activity, dash, dead images, close quote. Thus the images that the human being produces for themselves of the physical world are also dead images. We fail to understand the actual nature of this content of the intellect if we ascribe to it something other than that it can be a copy of the physical world. But the matter immediately becomes quite different when the human being reaches the point of living with the experiences of their existence over time. When we confront the things of the outside world and form images of them through the intellect, we get dead concepts. But if we allow these concepts to be present in our soul, then after some time, when the experience of which we have formed an image has long passed, we can, through memory, as we say, bring up the image of that experience from memory. We can say, well, I know nothing about the experience now, but when I remember, it arises. It may not have been in my consciousness before I remembered, but it is there, somewhere down in my soul, that is, unconsciously. I just have to raise it from the unconscious first. So the image of an earlier experience that I saw in the past is down there in the unconscious. Fine, it's down there. I'll raise it. But down there is not so devoid of meaning. You have only to take the quite ordinary difference between a conception which we receive from an experience, such that it gives us joy, elevates us, and a conception from some experience which has given us no joy. Now we can push down into the unconscious a conception that has given us pleasure, and we can push down into the unconscious a conception that has not given us pleasure. Very few people think about what might be said about the difference between such a joyful and such a sorrowful, painful conception. But there is a huge difference. And this difference occurs especially when we try to get behind the reality value of such conceptions that have actually already faded from normal memory. So let us keep to a conception which has given a person pleasure, but which they have had no reason to think back to in later life. Or a conception which has caused them pain, and which they have also had little reason to think back to. They do not rise into their consciousness, but they play a role in the unconscious life of the soul. If only people were willing to understand out of spiritual science what conceptions stored in the soul mean, even if they are completely forgotten. We are actually always the result of our experiences. The countenance we bear, especially in the more intimate gestures, is indeed a reflection of what we have experienced in this incarnation of ours. You can tell from the faces of people whether they have experienced a lot of sadness in their childhood. So, what is going on down there is, in other words, involved in the life processes of the human being. Whatever inhibiting, sad ideas are pushed down into oblivion, into the unconscious, that wears us out. It cuts off our vitality. The joyful and uplifting things we've experienced revive us. And if we study the fate of our mental life in the unconscious, then we find how tremendously dependent the present mood, the whole condition of a person is, on what rests there in their subconscious below. Now, compare the conceptions in our memory, the conceptions that have then already entered the unconscious soul life, with the conceptions that we currently have in our consciousness. Then you will say to yourself, the conceptions that we currently have in our consciousness are dead. Dead conceptions are not involved in our life process. They do not begin to be involved in our life process until they delve down into the unconscious, when they become life-enhancing or life-inhibiting ideas. So that the conceptions do not properly begin to live until they are forced down into the deeper recesses of the soul. I have always drawn attention to this in the lectures I have given in various places on the hidden grounds of the soul life. So the conceptions that are initially dead conceptions begin to live when they are implanted into our soul life. But the more unconscious they become for us, the more they begin to take on life. If we now follow the process with spiritual scientific cognition, then something very peculiar happens, which I can actually only describe in this way, and Steiner begins to draw. Assume that this is the boundary between conscious and unconscious. This line is the boundary between conscious, which is above, and unconscious, which is below. And now we have formed all kinds of conceptions in our consciousness. Let me designate them schematically by various shapes. We have formed these conceptions. Let's assume that these conceptions go down into the unconscious. They go down there, he draws arrows. So, you see, if we now follow these conceptions with spiritual scientific cognition, then they are transformed. Outwardly, we have seen that they become life-enhancing or life-inhibiting. Inwardly, it becomes apparent through spiritual scientific cognition that in sliding down below the surface, as it were, they become imaginations. There, in the unconscious or subconscious, everything that goes down becomes imagination. Everything becomes an image. You can have the most abstract conceptions in your ordinary day consciousness. When you go down below the threshold of ordinary day consciousness, everything becomes imagination. That is to say, there is a process in the human being, a sum of events, which is always endeavoring, in that the dead conceptions of the earthly, ordinary, materialistic consciousness go into the subconscious, to transform in every human being, before they arrive at imaginative cognition, all the cognitions in their consciousness into images, into imaginations in the unconscious. If then we wish to designate what we have of our conceptual life in the unconscious, if we wish to become acquainted with it, we must actually say all of it consists of unconscious imaginations, and all the conceptions which we can in turn raise from the unconscious into consciousness, we must raise by an activity which also remains unconscious to us. We must bring them back into consciousness, but strip them of their image character, transform them back into abstract, non-pictorial conceptions. And when you are actively considering, "Let me think, I experienced something. What was it?" and make an effort, you all know the process, to remember something, then that is the effort which you must make in order to strip the image that sits down there of its pictorial character and transform it back into the imaginative form of consciousness. But from this you will see that when we push the conceptions down into the unconscious, they become more spiritual. So we have to say, if we take what the intellect offers us into the unconscious, then we have to characterize the conceptual world that is there in us and that we have pushed down as a higher, as a more spiritual world. So we have to say, the world of possible memories. Please note that I say the world of possible memories. Not all the conceptions that go down there need to be remembered again, but they are all down there in the unconscious life of the soul. The world of possible memories actually consists in imaginations, in unconscious imaginations. Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, "world of possible memories, imaginations," close quote. Now, for the normal consciousness of a person, there is sometimes the possibility, and perhaps we will be able to talk about other such possibilities in the next few days, of bringing up into consciousness these images that would otherwise never pass from a possible memory into a real memory. Take the experiences that drowning people sometimes have. And if you could compare with this the experiences of people who have passed through the gateway of death, you would find that even there some conceptions, where the effort in ordinary physical life is not sufficient to bring them up again, then rise up as if of their own accord. But episodes, parts also rise up in the ordinary dream world. The dream, too, as it confronts us, is a complicated reality, because the things which are experienced actually lie behind it in many instances. But the conceptions we wrap around it are taken from the memory. So the dream, the experiences of those wrestling with death, such as drowning people and the like, and experiences had immediately after passing through the gateway of death, these reveal this world of imagination, which is a more spiritual world than the world of ordinary human intelligence on the physical plane. But if you take what I described earlier, that these conceptions which have passed into the region of possible memories work to enhance life or inhibit life, you will say to yourself, there is some life in there. Whereas the conceptions of the ordinary intellect are dead, some life enters in there, but it is not a very strong life. But even there, ordinary experience can offer something that can show you that what happens with these conceptions that descend into the subconscious region can nevertheless mean an even stronger life. I have already pointed out the very common fact that people who have to learn something by heart in order to recite it, learn it, and sleep on it, and that this sleeping on it is part of making the memory more capable. This, however, is only a faint hint at something which spiritual science shows much more clearly, indeed completely clearly, namely that our entire conceptual world, in that we shape it and push it down into the subconscious, becomes more and more alive and vivid in the subconscious, while it is dead in the consciousness. But now the conceptions that rise up again are not even those that are most involved in enhancing or inhibiting life. but it is those conceptions that are even more intimately connected with us. Conceptions that we often only see as accompanying life, to which we don't pay that much attention in life, they connect with our life-enhancing or life-inhibiting forces to a much greater extent. Let us assume for a minute that someone is engaged in spiritual science. They begin by taking it in, this spiritual science, as worked on by the physical intellect. That is what they have to start with. We have to build on what the physical intellect perceives through the senses. Otherwise, I would not be able to speak about the spiritual world at all, because language is there for the physical world. But there is a difference in how we, I might say, take in such a conceptual world as it is clothed in life. Suppose a person takes in the truths of spiritual science with seriousness and dignity, such that they feel seriousness, profound seriousness is involved. Another person takes in the ideas of spiritual science in such a way that they actually only listen to them theoretically and does not let them approach with any seriousness. The one receives them in an atmosphere of superficiality, as it were, the other in an atmosphere of seriousness. We do not need to be very aware of how we receive them. It is much more connected with how we go through life without always thinking about it. Those who are predisposed or accustomed to taking things seriously, and not frivolously or cynically, do not always think about how to take them. They behave seriously and naturally. Likewise, the person who is only superficially inclined takes them superficially. They can't help it. In this way, we accompany our conceptual life with something that we do not bring to mind, which is really something that runs in parallel to our consciousness. But the thing that runs in parallel with our consciousness goes much deeper into the unconscious than what we think consciously. So the way we form our conceptions goes down much deeper into the unconscious than what we consciously think. And when a person is asleep and their astral body and I, capital, are out of the physical and etheric body, then this way of forming conceptions plays an infinitely great role in the astral body and I. We can thus say, a person who takes in any conceptions with the necessary seriousness has these conceptions in their astral body and in their eye in such a way that they are contained in them, like the enlivening power of the sun is contained in the plant. They are truly enlivening forces to the highest degree. And they take into these conceptions that which is enlivening, enlivening and transcending the present incarnation, and creating the preconditions for the next incarnation. Here we already see through the creative soul that you have something in the subconscious that is more spiritual than that which can be raised through a dream. Here we have a world of the unconscious conceptual life connected with the entire essence of a person's being at its core. This way of taking life penetrates, as it were, into our spiritual life forces, and it is just like unconscious inspiration. Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, "World of the unconscious conceptual life, inspirations," close quote. I will go on to explain to you, today we no longer have the time, how ordinary life already shows that these unconscious inspirations then unconsciously work in the human being even in the incarnation in which they are formed, but just unconsciously. Then I will further show you that there is still a higher world for human beings. But you can see from what has been set out today that the human soul life has an inner movement, that which is experienced on the physical plane, through the physical intelligence, is experienced further down, that it then ascends into more spiritual regions, ultimately into even more spiritual regions than we experience on the physical plane. The arrows are drawn. So the conceptual life is in inner movement, in an ascending movement. And now remember what I drew for you yesterday, how certain processes of the human being were represented in a descending movement, so that you can say to yourself, when I have the human being before me, there is a descending current and an ascending current in the human being, and they work together. how they work together will then be discussed tomorrow. And there's a diagram on the blackboard, and it says, first, world of the unconscious conceptual life, inspirations. Below that, world of possible memories, imaginations. Below that, intellectual activity, dead images. The end of lecture 1.